Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Tuesday, December 1st, and this is episode 25. I am extremely excited about today's show, mostly because we have so much to talk about. Our guest today has packed a lot into his career, all of it fascinating, some of it truly empowering. Alan Martin is the Research Director for Partnership Africa Canada, an organization best known for their Nobel Peace Prize-nominated work to halt the trade of conflict diamonds in Africa. Prior to joining the Partnership Africa Canada, Alan worked as a researcher for the late Jack Layton. Before that, he spent over a decade working as a journalist in Canada, the UK, various countries in sub-Saharan Africa. He's also taught international journalism with the Carleton University School of Journalism and Communications. Born and raised in Southern Africa, he holds a master's degree in conflict and development from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. And he's joining me by telephone from his office in Ottawa, Ontario. Alan Martin, welcome to Trent Voices.
Not a problem.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you heard the intro or not, but thank you for joining us from Ottawa today.
I am happy to be back on Trent Radio.
Yeah, you're not a Trent Radio newbie. You were here in the past, weren't you?
Well, certainly times when I was at Trent, and I think the last time was when I was doing a book tour for Frank Pranks when I was at Frank Magazine. That was a good 10 years ago.
Well, welcome back.
Which I recall was a very early morning interview after a very late night.
We're a lot more civilized here at Trent Voices. We understand the needs of our guests, and so that's why we're doing an afternoon one. Actually, I wanted to have you on the show a few weeks ago, but you were a tad busy. You were in Africa.
What were you doing in Africa? I was in Angola.
And what brought you to Angola?
Well, there was we are part of a something called the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme, which is a international regulatory scheme for the trade of rough diamonds. So they have two annual meetings every year, and the chairmanship of the KP changes every year. So Angola was the lucky culprit. So we had to go to Luanda to have those meetings.
And this gets right to the heart of the work that you do with Partnership Africa Canada. Before we get deeply into your work, tell us a little bit about the state of the rough diamond trade in Africa, which is what Partnership Africa Canada is really concerned with, or at least you're the part of the trade that concerns you most.
Yeah, sure. Well, big question, but back at the very beginning, the issues that got PAC involved were related to civil wars in primarily countries like Angola, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, where there was a very clear link between the trade of rough diamonds and civil war. So that was what got PAC one of a couple of organizations that really brought a lot of international attention to this issue, and led the diamond industry and diamond-producing countries to create the Kimberley Process. And since that time, we're still obviously engaged in that issue of human rights and the links to diamonds, but also looking more broadly at the some of the problems that arise in the artisanal diamond sector. And the majority of diamonds outside of countries like Canada, Australia, Russia, Botswana, are really essentially artisanal diamond producers. So you have very Dickensian conditions where individuals essentially with a shovel and a pick and a sieve will dig these huge holes in the ground looking for the miracle diamonds that are going to change their life, and most often never do. And so trying to talk about issues of how to get governments to instead of criminalizing that kind of behavior, trying to formalize it and bring those kind of miners into the legal trade, and to appropriately tax them and to not beat and kill them when they decide to try and make a living out of it.
Well, you bring up something interesting. So this isn't big businesses that are doing it; it's individuals. How do the profits from the sales of these independently found diamonds and other minerals end up translating into promoting civil unrest or civil war?
Well, you have you know, back in, again, and still to this day, you have, you know, big mining companies like De Beers or Rio Tinto, Alrosa in Russia, who are, you know, doing the industrial mining, the what we call kimberlites, where you sort of find the needle in the haystack with the pipe, and it through different geological things, the pipe hasn't been broken, and so it's a very, you know, you're just talking about a kind of massive industrial thing. Whereas in artisanal zones, you have, you know, essentially groups of individuals who, collectives or whatnot, who usually work for some kind of patron who, you know, gives them some money and covers their food costs while they dig these holes. And then they, in turn, have to pass on these diamonds to the patron who usually sells them in the capital cities. And then they enter the international market through, you know, selling those to people in either Antwerp or Dubai or anywhere. I mean, primarily Antwerp, Dubai, and Israel. And so those are things where as the diamond goes further away from the source, from the mine site, of course you start to see those diamonds increasing in value exponentially. So a diamond that, you know, perhaps gets the miner, you know, $50-$100 in the mine will later be sold in, you know, in jewelry stores around the world for, you know, exponentials of that, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. So it's a very unequal business for sure.
Give us an idea of where these diamonds end up and how they get there.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're talking about legal or illegal, right? I mean, you've got one of the benefits of the Kimberley process is that it encourages and actually requires trading and producing countries to work within the legal system and exchange certificates for shipments. So if you're shipping, you know, X number of carats with a certain value and certain weight from one country to the other, that shipment has to be accompanied by a Kimberley process certificate. However, you still do have instances in some jurisdictions where either there's human rights issues or perhaps there's been embargoes placed on those countries because of breaking the minimum requirements of the Kimberley process, where people will engage in smuggling. So you've seen this in Zimbabwe, for example. There was massive smuggling out of there a few years ago when they ran afoul of the KP. You see it in the Central African Republic right now, where individuals will look for ways to smuggle these goods into the legitimate market, and that's a lot tougher thing to track and to intercept.
And so then, how does Partnership Africa fit into this? How are they received in some of these tougher areas of Africa?
Well, it depends. I think there's we wrote some fairly hard-hitting reports on Zimbabwe, for example, that involved several field visits. And the first time I went, I was an unknown, and I, you know, sort of just very quietly sort of moved around and did interviews with people. And then after that first report, then they started to know who I was, and it was a lot more difficult for me to move around. But I think it depends on the country. It depends on the report, but generally people don't receive our reports very well, because they are usually fairly factual or very factual and usually cause a lot of heartburn for them.
Why don't we hear about this, or why don't we hear more about this? Why isn't this an issue in Canada, when obviously it is a global issue that should be getting attention?
Well, it's a good question. I think part of it is that you know, if you go back 15, 20 years when this issue of Fodi Sanko and Charles Taylor in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Jonas Savimbi in Angola, it was a very clear issue to respond to. It was you had, you know, pictures on newscasts and in magazines about you know, children with their arms cut off and their ears cut off, and like, it's just the, you know, the complete brutality of what these organizations were doing, these rebel organizations. And I think you know, now the issue has, I think in the largely in the public's mind, I think they believe that the Kimberley process has taken care of this issue, and the number of instances of rebel groups carrying out those kind of atrocities are certainly less. One thing we've struggled with is around this issue of how to redefine the, what constitutes a conflict diamond. To this day, the KP still continues to use a very outdated definition, which only covers abuses done by rebel groups. And the reality of it is that, today most of the violations you see are perpetrated either by governments or by private security companies. So it's a very different context, and I think that you also have very few examples of governments that are really engaged in egregious rights abuses. I mean, the last really big one was Zimbabwe, and we were we received quite a lot of attention, international attention, for the work we did about that. And we were quite actively thwarting the exportation of those diamonds into international markets, which obviously didn't make us a lot of friends in Zimbabwe. But it was something where I think it depends on on really the market. I think there's a a larger debate too around not necessarily diamonds, but the larger issues of conflict minerals. Coming out of mostly the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you have gold and other minerals that end up in people's tech toys, which are, I think, has really also consumed a lot of the public debate. I think diamonds have sort of maybe shrunk to the back burner compared to those other debates about gold and the other minerals.
You talk about you say we when we're talking about Partnership Africa, but for Alan Martin, what's Alan Martin's role on a day to day basis? What are you doing as research director?
Well, it's a broad title. I mean, it is doing research, so there are research reports we put out on different issues. We did one last year on the trading of gold, illegal gold and diamonds from Central Africa to mostly Dubai, to highlight that in instances of smuggling, it's not just a problem of African countries, it's also about other jurisdictions elsewhere that actually allow this this illegality and enable this illegality to happen. I also work as part of a technical team that gives a bit of advice to four African countries in West Africa about how to harmonize policies and practices to address all these issues of, for example, smuggling and a lot of common vulnerabilities that these countries have. In this case, it's Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Cote d'Ivoire, all the Ebola countries. And a lot of these countries have very weak institutions. They have very porous borders. They have networks of industry guys who are all related, through family or tribal connections or whatever it is. So these are all issues that, different. Sometimes also they have different taxation levels. And so if in the case of Sierra Leone, for example, they had very high taxation on diamonds that were called specials, ones that were worth over $500,000 or more. And so they were charging 15% tax, and all the other neighbors were charging 3%. And so, the Sierra Leone government only had one guy ever walk into the diamond office with a special, because these guys were just avoiding the taxation. So they would be taking it to other countries. So we were, encouraging Sierra Leone, and they actually ended up doing that, where they harmonized taxes. So it doesn't really matter, which country you're in; you're still going to have to pay the same amount of taxes. So things like that's what I do. And then also there's certainly a large part of it which involves advocacy, talking to industry groups, governments, trying to convince people that certain actions need to be taken on particular issues. So the most recent one when we were in Angola was around the United Arab Emirates being made the chair of the Kimberley process next year, and this is something which we objected to because we see them as a very problematic jurisdiction, and so we were sort of we are in the process now of recommending courses of action that UAE has to take in order for us to recognize their chairmanship. And one of the great things about the Kimberley process is that it's one of the first international initiatives which involves both governments, industry, and civil society. So even though we don't have a vote in any of the decisions that are made, we certainly have a lot of moral suasion, and we have the ability to, you know, we have an equal right at the, you know, to speak at the table and to essentially convince people that, that you know, of any concern we have. So right now we're trying to reach out to different people to convince the government of UAE that they have to take corrective action before we recognize their chairmanship.
It's important work, and it's by no means run-of-the-mill work, and it's by no means a run-of-the-mill organization. How did you get involved with Partnership Africa?
Yeah, it was kind of a good, it was a bit of a fluke. I was working as a political researcher for Jack Layton on the Hill, and I have a background in journalism, and I've got a big funny bone for Africa from, you know, being born and raised there. And something that, you know, has also taken a lot of my, attention, you know, in terms of studying and things of that. And so I saw this job ad come up, and it sort of was this great sort of mix of all the different things I did. You know, it had the investigative stuff, it had the writing, had you know, knowledge, you know, or need to you know, have a good experience around Africa. And so, yeah, it was just a very happy coincidence that it sort of mixed all these different things that I like doing.
Well, and you mentioned the research aspect, you mentioned the writing aspect of it, which are skills that you primarily think of in a university experience. And how do you see your Trent experience informing the work that you do now with Partnership Africa?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I think, you know, going back to Trent I think that what I just liked about it was an environment to sort of, you know, free learning, of just sort of like of being exposed to different people and different profs. And there was a lot of them that I think that, you know, I think about Jim Driscoll in the politics, poli-sci department, Magnus Gunther, you know, guys who I think just really encouraged this kind of idea of free learning and you know, also just the you know, what you learn outside the classroom with people who, you know, been involved in different organizations. And I think at the time, back at Trent, I was doing some human rights stuff around the anti-apartheid movement. And yeah, so I think there's a lot of things where I think that for me, Trent was a sort of this place where learning sort of started to make sense to me. I think up until that time, I had a very ambivalent relationship with learning, or at least in high school. And, you know, I did it because I needed to do it, but it wasn't something I really loved. And I think that really very much changed it. At Trent, where you sort of felt you were around these, you know, sympathetic misfits who all shared the same kind of, well, not necessarily shared exactly the same outlook on life, but certainly that they encouraged this idea of a similar internationalist kind of view of the world, and the place like Africa mattered, which was kind of a good thing to have, because I think in many university experiences, I don't think that that is necessarily the case.
I want to switch gears, because we were just talking about the world and we're talking about Africa, but I want to talk about Canada for a second. During the recent election, I was fortunate enough to catch you on Power and Politics on CBC.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. And you were talking about the screening process that parties use when they're selecting candidates, and that's obviously a great conversation for the last election. It was really fun to watch, because you were coming in as an insider. You were a government researcher, and you were working for Jack Layton. How was it to work with Jack Layton?
Oh, he was a great guy. I mean, he was, you know, I went to work for the NDP because of him. It was something I had at the time. I was writing a column for like one of the local, you know, rags in Ottawa, and I did an interview with him, you know, pretty much by the end of the interview, I was convinced that the guy was he was authentic and he was legitimate, and I think about a year later, I was, no, not even, less than a year later, I was working for him pretty soon after that. And he was, you know, I think one of the things about Jack that I like and I still, you know, keep with me is that he, you know, he came from a position of, you know, on city council in Toronto and things of that, where he was really shaking the cage on a lot of things. And, you know, one thing that he would repeatedly say was that, you know, you can't be oppositional without being propositional. You can certainly point out things, but you have to always be ready to propose an alternative course or another way of doing things. And I think that's something that I certainly still take with me in this job that I do now, that it's not good enough for, as a member of civil society, to kind of just be pointing out how a government or an industry is failing to do something the way you want them to do. You have to actually come and propose a way that they can do it better. And yeah, he was a great guy. I certainly miss him a lot.
Let's jump backwards to October 19th. I follow you on social media. You were very active when it came to what was going on with the last election. As a person who was an opposition researcher and a guy who's a former journalist, take me through what happened on October 19th, because I think, like many people, you were kind of surprised about that red tide that we first saw in Nova Scotia that then proceeded to be a comfortable majority throughout the rest of that evening.
Well, I don't know. I mean, politics is a tough business, and sometimes it goes your way and sometimes it doesn't. And you can never question the will of the people, right? I mean, that's what democracy is about. I think a lot of people are going to be still, you know, reading the tea leaves as to what really happened. And I think certainly, like, the NDP has a lot of internal questioning that it's going to have to do. And I should point out, I mean, I'm quite removed from it now. I mean, I obviously still support the party, and I'm a partisan, but I'm not, by no means, an insider anymore in terms of my involvement with him. But I think that, yeah, no, I mean, I think it's certainly a failure to communicate. I think there's certainly things where there was a very clear mandate and appetite by the Canadian people to get rid of Stephen Harper. And I think that at some point, well, for most of the part of the election, I think people were sort of in this three-way, who the hell are we going to support? And then I think at one point, I think when the NACAB thing opened up, I think that was something that affected the NDP in a way that it didn't the Liberals. The Liberals didn't have very many MPs in Quebec. That was a huge issue in Quebec, not in not really so much in the rest of the country. But I think that the NDP faced a bit of a catch-22, that if it sort of jumped on the bandwagon of some of the voices in Quebec who were very tough on the NACAB, and if Mulcair had said, yeah, we're going to ban the NACAB, or, you know, sort of close it up to the Tory line, then I think that would have played out very badly in the rest of the country. So I think they were screwed either way. And I think that perhaps the idea of the strategic voting was a bit more successful than people anticipated. I think a lot of people who engage in strategic voting actually don't really have an idea about how it actually works. And I think most people, you know, certainly in ridings where you already had very competent NDP MPs, I don't understand why you would even consider strategically voting. Because, I mean, in the process, you lost people, very, very good MPs like Peter Stauffer, Megan Leslie, Paul Dewar, Craig Harris, Scott in Toronto, Andrew Cash, I mean, Peggy Nash, all these people who are excellent MPs. And so, yeah. It is what it is.
I'd like to try and put on all three hats, if you will. Sure. You know, you work in the nonprofit sector for an organization with global impact. You're a former employee in the political sector, but you've also taught journalism. And I'm wondering what you think the state of responsible journalism is right now, because obviously the stories that need to be told coming out of Africa, well, they need to be told. Obviously, we've just gotten through, you know, a peak period in reporting on Canadian politics. As a guy who spent a decade reporting, What do you see as the state of journalism in Canada right now?
I think it's pretty abysmal. I mean, I think there's a lot of things where certainly, like, I think the idea of independent media in Canada is a farce, or objective media, which I've never been a big subscriber of objective media, because I think it's a bit of a crock of shit. I think there's a my sort of mantra was more, when I was doing journalism, was more about fairness and accuracy. I think that's a more honest way of doing things, and I think that it doesn't give this kind of moral equivalence to certain things which don't deserve it. And I think that the idea that journalists are going to be objectively able to write a story, for example, some middle class white kid going into black inner city to talk about race relations, is not going to have the same perspective as a black person who might be writing for the New York Times or whoever the paper is.
We're going to leave it there, though, because we've only got a minute. And because you're a diverse guy and a person with diverse interests and diverse experiences, I'm wondering what's next for Alan Martin. What's the near future hold for you?
Man, I don't know. I think I need to see a fortune teller. More of the same, I think. I wouldn't mind, if I could find some, fairy godmother to pay for it. I'd love to take some time off and write a book, but I I still have a mortgage to pay, so that's probably unlikely. But either nonfiction or fiction, who knows? Like, just something that gives me another challenge than what I do every day.
Well, if you're interested in doing any radio, I'm more than willing to welcome you to the chair beside me. In the meantime, that is all the time that we have today. We've got a ton more that we can talk about, and I think I'd love to have you back in the near future. In the meantime, I just want to say thanks. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, Don, it's been an absolute pleasure, and hello everybody there on Trent Radio, and I'd love to see you sometime when I'm next in Peterborough.
We'd love to have you for a visit. Yeah. That was 1990 alumnus Alan Martin joining us on the line. That was Alan Martin. I'm Donald Fraser of Trent University's Alumni Affairs. This has been Trent Voices. Be sure to catch all of our shows online at www.trentu.ca/alumni, and we'll see you next week.